spoke in a tired way, each word weighted down. They were in the process of deciding on a venue, Felicia said, and weren't sure of the number of guests. "This wedding is huge," she remarked. "How many people would you guess?" He looked around at the tables, counted 8 bodies at each. "Around 200, I think." He drained his water glass and looked over at Megan, her animated face without a trace of discomfort.
"Where was your wedding?" Felicia asked.
"We eloped 8 years ago, City Hall." It had seemed like the right thing to do at the time, instead of asking his parents to fly in from Lausanne, and Megan's parents to go to the expense, and figuring out how to make everybody happy. He was 29, Megan 34. It had been exhilarating, the joy of getting married, combined with the fact that it would be all in secret, without planning, without involvement from anyone else. His parents had not even met her. He was aware of what an insult it was to them. For all their liberal Western ways, he knew they wanted him to marry a Bengali girl, raised and educated as he had been. "Do you regret it at all?" Felicia asked. "I think our daughters do." For they were at the age now when they expected tales of a wedding cake, pictures of their mother in a white gown. Felicia asked how old the girls were, and again, clumsily, he pulled out the photos in his wallet. "Megan has better ones. More recent, I mean. But they're at the hotel."
"Did you have to try for a while?"
He thought it a bold question coming from a stranger, but he was honest with her, his thoughts still loose from the spiked lemonade. "Would you believe with Maya it happened the first time?" he said. He remembered how proud he'd felt, how powerful. The first time in his life he'd had sex without contraception, a life had begun.
"Will you go for a third?"
It's hard to imagine. He thought back to when his daughters were infants, when swings and play saucers crowded the rooms and the sticky tray of the high chair had to be scrubbed in the shower at the end of each night. His girls had already turned mysterious, both out of diapers, withdrawing to their room to read or play games, talking in secret languages, bursting into peals of laughter at the table for no apparent reason. He'd been more eager than Megan to start a family. It was exotic, the world of parenting, fulfilling him in a way his job did not. It was Amit who pushed for a second. Megan was content with one, telling him she'd paid the price for being from a large family. But Amit hadn't wanted Maya to be an only child, to lead the lonely existence he remembered. Megan had given in, gotten pregnant again even though she was almost 40, but since Monica's birth, she'd worn an IUD. A spoon clinked on a glass, and they all turned their attention to the front of the tent, to the first round of toasts. They listened to friends of Pam's from prep school and then from college, a few of whom he vaguely remembered drinking with at the Marlin. They were followed by members of both families and co-workers of Pam's and Ryan's. Amit was distracted by a pale gray spider that crawled up the side of the tablecloth and then into the space between the cuff of Jared's shirt and jacket. He was tempted to say something, but Jared hadn't noticed. Instead, he sat there, the same faint smile still fixed on his face, no doubt anticipating the day people would stand up and offer toasts at his own wedding. The entree was served, plates of prime rib with asparagus and potatoes. "How was it going from one child to two?" Felicia inquired, picking up the conversation where they'd left it. "A friend of mine told me that 1 + 1 = 3. Is it true?" She sliced into her prime rib, causing blood from the meat to seep into the potatoes. He considered for a moment. "Actually, it was after the second that our marriage sort of," he paused, searching for the right word, "disappeared." He realized it was a funny word to use, but something had been lost, something had fallen through their fingers, and that was the only way he could put it.
"What do you mean?" Felicia asked.
She set down her fork and squinted at him with her small eyes, her voice suddenly cold. He looked over at Megan, full of the radiance that had graced her this evening, still talking to Jared. In the hotel, they had vowed not to leave each other's side, but she was miles away from him. He felt the same resentment that often seized him after he cleaned up the kitchen and bathed Maya and Monica and put them to bed and then watched television alone, knowing that he had seen his children through another day, that again Megan had not been a part of it. She lived in the apartment. She slept in his bed. Her heart belonged to no one but him and the girls, and yet, there were times Amit felt as alone as he had first been at Langford. And there were times he hated Megan, simply for this. Had he been sober, he would have repressed the thought, reminding himself that it was for his sake and the girl's that she worked so hard. He would have reminded himself that in a year or so their lives would change, that Megan hoped to find a job in a private practice so they would once again be able to go on family vacations and throw dinner parties for their friends. But tonight, nothing censored his peevishness. He embraced it, felt justified by his very ability to acknowledge what was true.
"It disappeared," he repeated, with more force this time. "I guess it does for everyone sooner or later."
But Felicia's face had hardened. "What an awful thing to say," she said, not hiding her disgust. "At a wedding of all places." And yet, he felt justified. Wasn't it since Monica's birth that so much of his and Megan's energy was devoted not to doing things together, but devising ways so that each could have some time alone? She taking the girls so that he could go running in the park on her days off, or vice versa, so that she could browse in a bookstore or get her nails done? And wasn't it terrible how much he looked forward to those moments, so much so that sometimes even a ride by himself on the subway was the best part of the day? Wasn't it terrible that after all the work one put into finding a person to spend one's life with, after making a family with that person, even in spite of missing that person, as Amit missed Megan night after night, that solitude was what one relished most? The only thing that, even in fleeting, diminished doses, kept one sane? He considered explaining this to Felicia, but he saw that she no longer wanted to talk to him. She had been hanging on his every word, but now she turned her attention to one of the women in silver jewelry. He looked at his watch and saw that it was almost 8:30. The girls would be in their nightgowns reading stories before bedtime. He had not finished his meal, had eaten very little of it in fact, but the plate was cleared away and strawberry shortcake was in its place. He looked up and saw that most of the tables were empty. Dancing had begun, couples clinging to each other under a neighboring tent, surrounded by the mountains, the black night. The band was playing a Gershwin song. Jared led Felicia away, and though Amit knew he would never have to see her again, he was relieved to see her go, taking away the depressing evidence of their conversation. Jared was bending down to hear something Felicia was whispering, and Amit wondered if she was relaying what he'd said to her. How inappropriate, they would think, to talk that way to a person who was engaged. And they would promise each other not to let that happen in their own marriage, that even after 12 children they would never feel that way. He saw Ted drifting over, asking Megan if it was all right to sit in the empty chair beside her.
"That was quite a meal. I didn't eat half as well at my own wedding," he said.
"I should call the girls," Megan said. "We promised them we would."
"I'll go," Amit offered. "You stay, Meg. Enjoy yourself." "I won't run off with her," Ted said, winking. "I promise."
"Are you sure you're okay?" Megan asked Amit.
From the way she was looking at him, he saw, without his having to say anything, that she knew he'd had too much to drink, that she had still paid attention to him while speaking to other men all evening.
"I'm fine. I'll go find a payphone and then I'll be right back. A walk will do me good."
"But then we dance the night away and watch the sunrise, okay?"
She smiled at him, and he felt her love for him suddenly. That unshakable belief in him and in their marriage that she never questioned, never denigrated, as he had tonight.
"Okay."
He walked over to where she was sitting, bent down and kissed her on the cheek, then went up to the admissions building where the bathrooms were. Two large rooms had been opened up for the children to play in. Some were running around, some crying, others sprawled fast asleep on the leather club chairs and sofas. He wandered around looking for a payphone. There were only the kind limited to the campus exchange or private ones sitting on desks. He saw them through the glass doors of offices, but when he tried the knobs, they were all locked. He walked outside to see if maybe there was a phone there. He found nothing, and yet he had to call the girls, wanted to hear their voices. This was the sole thought in his mind. He began to cut across the field in the dark in the direction of the hotel, forgetting that the car was parked at the school. Instead, he stumbled across the field, silent except for the faint sound of the music carried across the air and the sound of his own breathing. He stopped and looked up at the sky and the stars, the constellations that were so piercing outside the city. He thought of Megan, thought maybe he should go back and tell her he was going to the hotel.
but he continued walking, unable to see his feet as they marched across the ground. There were no lights apart from the stars, and he was unsure which direction the hotel was in. And then, again, he stopped, to listen to the serenade of the frogs that lived around the lake, like the repeated random plucking of a bowed instrument in an orchestra, endlessly tuning itself before a performance. It was a sound he had forgotten, one that had haunted him and kept him awake his first nights in a Langford dormitory at the end of another August when he was 15 years old. All the incoming students heard it as they slept in their new rooms, in their strange beds, missing their parents, their homes. They were told at their first assembly that the frogs were calling for their mates, defending their territory by the water's edge before burying themselves under mud for the winter. The deafening thrum spoke to Amit tonight as it had then, of everything in the world that teemed beyond his vision, that was beyond his grasp. He saw the hotel. It had taken no time at all. Megan wouldn't even notice he had been gone. He went into the room and sat on the bed that was empty, as opposed to the one used for their discarded clothes and luggage, and picked up the telephone. He looked around the room, and what he had earlier found disappointing, he now found comforting. He dialed his in-law's area code, but he could not remember the rest of the number. He sat there for a long time, the phone in his lap, trying to remember the digits. But he did not know them by memory. It was Megan who always called. He studied the paper pyramid from all sides, as if that might hold the answer. But no, those were television channels. He would have to go back to the wedding, ask Megan, and then come back again to the hotel. That was what he would do. He stood up, walking across the room to the door. Then he remembered that he could call directory assistance. He returned to the phone and was about to press the buttons, but his head throbbed and things began to spin, the paper pyramid on the bedside table no longer where it had been a second ago, and the need to be horizontal overwhelmed him, pulling him back to the pillows on the bed. He woke up dressed in his suit, polished black shoes on his feet. The light was on in the dark room, the curtain to the balcony drawn. He first thought that it was still nighttime and that he had to get back to the wedding. But then he looked at the digital clock on the bedside table and saw that it was 11 in the morning. "Megan?" he called out. He could barely form the word. His voice was ragged, and he realized that for a long time in his sleep he'd been craving a glass of water. He sat up a little and became aware of an excruciating band of pressure around his head. Looking at the neighboring bed, he saw that it had not been slept in, that the open suitcase and clothes had not been moved aside. He sat up fully and then stood. "Megan?" he called out again. He took off his jacket, went to the bathroom, drank water from the basin. He couldn't bear to turn the light on. The night began to come back to him in pieces. He remembered sitting on the toilet seat just minutes ago, it seemed, inspecting Megan's skirt. Then he remembered watching Pam Borden getting married and waiting in a long line for a drink and a conversation at dinner with a woman who was engaged. He remembered leaving Megan at the table with another man. Suddenly, he jerked on the light and saw that her glasses were not by the basin where she normally left them during the night, that she had not come back to the hotel. He returned to the bed in which he'd slept, searching for some sign of her on the other side of it. But the cover had not been turned back. There were only the creases indicating where he'd lain. Again he crossed the room. He yanked open the closet which contained just a few empty hangers on the rod. He decided to go to the front desk and ask if she'd returned. He felt chilly and put on his jacket again. Then he saw that the door to the balcony was partly open. She was sitting in a chair, in jeans and a fleece pullover she'd wisely packed, thinking it might be cold in the mountains. The diamond studs he'd given her after Maya's birth sparkled in her ears. She was sipping coffee from a paper cup and was staring at the pine tree that blocked the view. "Well, I made it to watch the sunrise like I said I would," she said. "Only the sunrise wasn't visible today." He looked at the sky. It was full of daylight, but uniformly gray. The air was cool, and rain seemed imminent. He eyed the empty chair next to Megan, knowing he wasn't welcome. She had not turned around to face him, had not looked up, and he stood partly behind her, shivering, his arms crossed in front of him.
"When did you get back?" he asked her.
"Oh, it must have been around 3. That was when the party finally broke up. My feet are killing me. I haven't danced like that in years."
Her words made him think that perhaps his memories had been part of a terrible dream.
Did we dance last night at the wedding?
It was only for about an hour that I was out of my mind with worry. We looked for you everywhere. I asked strange men to check underneath bathroom stalls. I even considered calling the police. But then something told me you'd ended up back here, and when I called the hotel, that's exactly what they told me. She said all of this calmly, as if addressing the tree in front of her, and yet he felt her fury in each word.
I couldn't find a payphone, he said.
She turned to him then, jerking the chair around while still sitting in it, her eyes wet with tears. Neither could I. But I asked Pam's father, and he opened up one of the offices.
Amit looked down at his feet, at his muddied wingtips. I left the car up there. Did you drive it back?
How could I, when the keys were in your pocket?
How did you get here, then?
He felt as if he might be sick, remembering Ted, thinking of him accompanying her to the hotel in the middle of the night.
Oh, that nice couple at our table gave me a ride, Jared and Felicia.
He knew that she'd been virtuous, that she was telling him the truth. At the same time, feeling sick again, he wondered if Felicia had told Megan what he'd said.
How are the girls?
They're fine, they're having a blast. I told my parents we'll be there by afternoon. But we're staying here until tomorrow. That was the plan. It's a bit silly, don't you think, given the weather? The concierge said it's only supposed to get worse.
10 years ago, it wouldn't have mattered. They would have laughed at the rain, gone for a walk anyway, then holed up in the room and made love.
I'm sorry, Meg. The drinks went straight to my head. I don't even remember having that many.
I didn't mean to abandon you.
She didn't acknowledge his apology. Instead, she said, I've had breakfast. I can go get the car before the rain starts while you pack up. The hotel restaurant's not bad. You should probably eat something. I'm tired and I want you to be able to drive back.
You're always tired, he wanted to tell her. The only time you haven't been tired in years was last night. But he knew that he was in no position to accuse her.
Well,
she said. There's a brunch, he remembered. And suddenly, he felt hopeful that there was still a bit of the wedding left, that he could make an appearance, make up for what he'd missed.
I can eat there. I'd like to go and say goodbye to Pam and Ryan, he said. Let's go over together, please. She opened her mouth to say something, then stopped. His head was pounding and his voice was cracking, and from the sad look in her eyes, he knew that he looked pathetic, that it was out of pity that she refused to raise her voice to berate him. Eventually, she said, If that's what you want, you'll go with me? I've spent enough time at this wedding by myself. She sat on the balcony reading the local paper while he changed out of his suit and into his ordinary clothes. Then he packed up their things, throwing all the tourist brochures into the garbage. They walked across the road and across the field to Langford. They were halfway there when the rain started. It was an undramatic drizzle, filling the air with the faintest sound, but by the time they reached the edge of campus, their hair was damp, their feet drenched and cold. At one point, they paused to take in a view of the lake. In spite of the rain, a man swam in the dark gray water quite far out. They went past the small cemetery on the grounds of the school, along a path that led them to a sign taped to a stake that said, Brunch, with an arrow. They headed in that direction, keeping their eye out for another sign. The tents under which people had dined and danced were still up, empty now, the tables folded and stacked in piles. The chairs on which they'd sat to watch the ceremony were still arranged more messily on the lawn. There was a truck parked in front of the alumni building where two maintenance men in overalls were clearing up. Is the brunch in here? Amit asked.
Don't know anything about a brunch,
one of them said. They walked in the direction of the chapel and the observatory. They passed the parking lot where a few cars stood, including their own. They reached the front gates of the school, then turned back again.
I don't see any other signs, Megan said. Did she say which building?
Amit shook his head, and they continued on. United in their quest, he wondered if her rage was dissipating, and yet they did not walk side by side. She was ahead of him, leading the way even though she did not know it. When doors were open, they entered, wandering down musty carpeted hallways into naked stairwells, past empty classrooms with clean blackboards and the round wooden tables at which Langford students always sat. In less than a month, students would return to those tables. He was free of the school. It no longer touched his life in any way. But instead of feeling grateful, he wanted to relive those confused days, that life of discovery, to be bound to those round tables and lectures and exams. There were things he had always meant to understand better. Russian history, the succession of Roman emperors, Greek philosophy. He wanted to read what he was told each evening, to do as he was told. There were the great writers he had never read, would never read. His daughters would begin that journey soon enough, the world opening up for them in its awesome entirety. But there was no time now, not even to look at the whole paper on Sundays. In the music complex, they found a room with an assortment of couches and practice stands. There was a baby grand piano in the corner, and in front of it two trash bins filled with coffee cups and crushed boxes from a bakery. A long folding table held a coffee percolator, a stack of unused cups. "We found it," Amit said, feeling triumphant. And then, just as instantly, he felt thwarted. He saw an open box on the table containing a few eclairs. The sight made his stomach churn up in hunger, and he picked one up, consumed it without pause. "Looks like we missed brunch," Megan said. After a while, she added, "You have chocolate icing around your mouth." Lacking a napkin or the wipes he always had with him when he was with the girls, he drew the back of his hand across his lips. The bells of the chapel chimed as if for the two of them alone. He thought of Pam and Ryan on their way to the airport, to their honeymoon in Scotland. He thought of the other guests heading back, pleasantly hungover, and the Bordens relaxing at home, commenting on the evening, saluting themselves on a job well done. They headed towards the parking lot to get the car. The rain was heavy now, the sound of it percussive against the leaves of the trees. Had the wedding been today instead of yesterday, Amit thought to himself, everything would have been different. They would have gathered in the chapel. Everyone would have remarked what a shame it was. The rain came down harder, and they both began picking up their pace, half jogging side by side, Megan keeping a hand pressed over her head. They approached Standish Hall, the dorm in which they could have stayed. The front door was open, held by a large rock. "Let's wait this out for a few minutes," Amit said, panting for breath. "I need to use the bathroom." In the entryway on a bulletin board was a list of room assignments for the wedding guests. He left Megan standing there reading the names on the list while he went to the bathroom. All along the hallway the doors were open, beds stripped, sheets folded up on top of them. In the bathroom, the shower stalls separated by slabs of gray marble still had beads of water on them from the morning's use. When he returned, Megan was no longer in the entryway. He began walking down the remaining length of the hall and found her in one of the rooms, perched on the edge of a desk. She was looking at a Xeroxed sheet of paper that someone had stepped on, leaving the dusty imprint of a shoe's sole. "The brunch ended at 11," she said. The arrangement of the room was familiar to him, but things had been redone since his time here. There was a new fire alarm, blonde wood furniture. The mattress looked firmer without the black and white ticking he remembered. There was a tan carpet covering the floor. The shade half pulled on the window was fresh with a ring attached to the string. The effect was more sanitized. Less charming, a lot like the inside of the Chadwick Inn. He opened the closet barely deep enough for a hanger. "You know, we should have just stayed here," Megan said. "We would have saved $200 and I wouldn't have spent half the night worried you'd vanished into thin air." He closed the closet, then shut the door to the room. There was no way to lock it from the inside. "My fault for trying to have a romantic getaway." "But this is so much more romantic," she spoke objectively. But he also detected a note of regret. When he turned to her, she was preoccupied, slightly frowning. She had removed her glasses, raised her fleece pullover, and was wiping the delicate lenses on the t-shirt underneath. Her pulled back hair was slick against her head. Her cheeks flushed from running. She held out the glasses in front of her face, inspecting them before putting them back on. "Was it in a room like this that you had sex for the first time?" It was something after all these years that she didn't know about him. In spite of her anger, his past still preyed on her, if only because she hadn't been a part of it. "I didn't have sex at Langford. Anyway, it was a boys' school back then. I refused to believe there weren't ways to sneak girls in." "Well, there were, but I never did. I've told you a million times I was miserable here." "What about Pam?" Megan asked, folding her arms across her chest, glancing over at the bed. "Did you ever have sex with her?" "No." She took a step towards him, looking at the shirt that clung coldly to his body, then directly into his eyes. "What then?
Something passed between you two, it's obvious.
It was nothing, Meg. We were friends, and for a while I had a crush on her, but nothing happened. Is that so terrible?
The information fell between them, valuable for the years he'd kept it from her, negligible now that he'd told. Through the window he saw the workmen in the rain folding up the chairs and stacking them onto a cart. He went to the window and pulled down the shade, completely darkening the room. Then he turned back to Megan, close to her now. He kneeled on the floor and put his arms around her legs, pressing his face against her jeans. She did not walk away as he feared, did not detangle herself from his awkward embrace. Then he felt her hand on top of his head, her long fingers grazing the gray hairs of his skull, and instantly, powerfully, he felt an erection. He began to kiss her legs, grasping at her belt loops and pulling her down so that she was kneeling on the carpet too. He put a hand up against the thick inseam of her jeans, knowing exactly what it was like to touch her there, the combination of skin and bone and hair. He looked at her and he saw that although her face was turned away, she had relaxed her body, adjusting herself to accommodate his hand.
"We can't do this here," she whispered.
And yet, she was tipping back her head, allowing him to push up her fleece pullover.
"Why not?"
He was kissing her neck now, and then her mouth, strong, open-mouthed kisses that she was returning. He took her hand and placed it under his belt. She looked at him then, with slight tenderness, and shook her head.
"It's a dorm room, Amit. Kids live here."
But he continued, guiding her hand to his belt buckle while forcing off her clothes. The fleece, the soft t-shirt below that. Her hair came undone. He pulled down her jeans, revealing thighs that were chilled and reddened as if from a sunburn. They took off their shoes and socks, a mess of wet grass clippings falling onto the carpet, then positioned themselves on the mattress. He couldn't remember the last time they'd done this outside their apartment, outside their bedroom, where they were always nervous that the girls would walk in. They were nervous now, but they were excited too, knowing they could get caught. He entered her and felt her hands on his back, warming him, her ankles around the backs of his legs, and the shock of her tongue in his ear. She offered to turn over, knowing that this was the quickest way, but he wanted to face her. He placed his hands on her hips, over the stretch marks that were like inlaid streaks of mother-of-pearl that would never fade, whose brilliance spoke only for the body's decay. He put his mouth to one of her breasts, flattened and drained after nursing two children, tasting the film of perspiration that had gathered. Her breathing became audible, and then she cried out loudly enough for anyone in the neighboring rooms to know what was taking place. But no one discovered them, no workmen came to clean up, no guest from the wedding strayed in, no little girls intruded giggling into the room. He came inside her and sat up, knowing they could not linger. He was looking at the clothes they needed to put on again. Megan's eyes were on his face, an arm stretched in front of her and a hand pressed to his chest as if to prevent him now that they were finished from collapsing on top of her again. But he hoped that he was forgiven, and for a few moments they remained together on the narrow bed in the little room, his heart beating rapidly, vigorously, plainly striking the skin of her palm.
Only goodness. It was Sudha who introduced Raoul to alcohol. One weekend he came to visit her at Penn, to his first drink from a keg, and then, the next morning in the dining hall, his first cup of coffee. He pronounced both beverages revolting, preferring schnapps to the beer, and emptying a dozen packets of sugar in his coffee cup. That had been his junior year of high school. When she was home the following summer, he asked her to buy him some six-packs, planning to have a party one weekend when their parents were going to be in Connecticut overnight. He'd shot up to 6 feet, braces off his teeth, whiskers sprouting around his mouth, dark pimples occasionally studding his cheekbones, her little brother in name only. She went to a local liquor store, helping Raoul divvy up the cans between his room and hers so that their parents wouldn't discover them. After her parents were asleep, she brought some cans into Raoul's room. He snuck downstairs, bringing back a cup of ice cubes to chill down the warm Budweiser. They shared one cupful, then another, listening to the Stones and the Doors on Raoul's record player, smoking cigarettes next to the open window and exhaling through the screen. It was as if Sudha were in high school again, doing things she once hadn't had the wits or guts for. she felt a new bond with her brother, a sense, after years of regarding him as just a kid, that they were finally friends. Suda had waited until college to disobey her parents. Before then, she had lived according to their expectations, her persona scholarly, her social life limited to other demure girls in her class, if only to ensure that one day she would be set free. Out of sight in Philadelphia, she studied diligently, double majoring in economics and math, but on weekends she learned to let loose, going to parties and allowing boys into her bed. She began drinking, something her parents did not do. They were prudish about alcohol to the point of seeming puritanical, frowning upon the members of their Bengali circle, the men, that was to say, who liked to sip whiskey at gatherings. In her freshman year, there had been nights when she got so drunk that she was sick on the streets of campus, splattering the sidewalk and stumbling back to her dorm with friends. But she learned what her limits were. The idea of excess, of being out of control, did not appeal to Suda. Competence. This was the trait that fundamentally defined her. After Raul graduated from high school, their parents celebrated, having in their opinion now successfully raised two children in America. Raul was going to Cornell, and Suda was still in Philadelphia, getting a master's in international relations. Their parents threw a party, inviting nearly 200 people, and bought Raul a car, justifying it as a necessity for his life in Ithaca. They bragged about the school, more impressed by it than they'd been with Penn. "Our job is done," her father declared at the end of the party, posing for pictures with Raul and Suda at either side. For years they had been compared to other Bengali children, told about gold medals brought back from science fairs, colleges that offered full scholarships. Sometimes Suda's father would clip newspaper articles about unusually gifted adolescents, the boy who finished a PhD at 20, the girl who went to Stanford at 12, and taped them to the refrigerator. When Suda was 14, her father had written to Harvard Medical School, requested an application, and placed it on her desk. Suda's example had taught her parents that there was nothing to fear about sending a child to college. Raul took it in stride as well, not overly anxious as Suda had been the summer before she had gone away. He was almost indifferent to the changes ahead, his attitude reminding her that he'd always been the smarter one. Suda has struggled to keep her place on the honor roll, to become salutatorian of her high school class, but Raul never lifted a finger, never cracked a book unless it appealed to him, precocious enough to have skipped third grade. At the end of the summer, Suda went to Wayland to help him pack, but when she got there, she saw that there was nothing left for her to do. He had already stuffed his bags, filled some milk crates with records, grabbed sheets and towels from the linen closet, wrapped the cord around his electric typewriter. He told her she didn't need to go all the way to Ithaca, but she insisted, riding beside him as he drove his new car, their parents following behind. The campus was on a hilltop surrounded by farms and lakes and waterfalls, nothing like Penn. She helped him unload his things, carrying boxes across the quadrangle, along with other families of incoming freshmen. When it was time to say goodbye, their mother wept, and Suda cried a little too, at the thought of abandoning her little brother, still not 18, in that remote, majestic place. But Raul did not behave as if he were being either abandoned or liberated. He pocketed the money their father counted out and gave him as they parted, and he turned back towards his dormitory before Suda and her parents had pulled away. The next time she saw him was Christmas. At dinner, he had nothing specific to say about his classes, or his professors, or new friends he had made. His hair had grown long enough to conceal his neck and to tuck behind his ears. He wore a checked flannel shirt and around his wrist a knotted woven bracelet. He did not eat the enormous amount Suda still did when she sat at her mother's table. He seemed bored, watching but not helping when Suda and her mother decorated the tree with the ornaments she and Raul had made when they were little. Suda remembered always seeming to come down with the flu over Christmas break, collapsing once she was free of the pressure of the exams, and thought that Raul might do so too. But later that evening, finding her upstairs where she was wrapping gifts in her room, he seemed to have perked up. "Hey, where did you hide it?" he asked. "Hide what?" "Don't tell me you came home empty-handed." "Oh," she said, realizing what he meant. "It didn't occur to me. I just thought, since you're in college." It was true. It hadn't occurred to her this time to stick a six-pack into her bag. She preferred wine now, a glass with dinner when she went out with her friends in Philadelphia, but she did not expect it when she came home to Wayland. "I'm still not old enough to buy anything here." He glanced around the room as if it might contain what he sought, looking at her closet and her chest of drawers, at the bed that was covered with wrapping paper and a box from Filene's containing a nightgown for her mother. "Trip to the liquor store?" he suggested, sitting on top of the bed, crushing some wrapping paper she had unrolled. His hand sifted through the gift tags, the tape, picking up each item and then dropping it again. "Now?" she asked. "Do you have any other plans for the evening?" "Well, no, but Ma and Baba are going to think it's weird if we go out all of a sudden." He rolled his eyes. "Jesus, Dee Dee, you're almost 24. Do you really still care what they think?" "I was about to get into my pajamas." He picked up the scissors, his eyes focused on the slow opening and closing of the blades, as if discovering their function for the first time. "Since when did you get so boring?" She knew he was joking, but the remark hurt her, nevertheless. "Tomorrow, I promise." He stood up, distant again, as he had been at dinner, and then she felt herself faltering. "I guess it's still open," she said, looking at her watch. And so she'd gone, lying to her parents that she needed to get something last minute at the mall, Raoul saying he'd drive her there. "You're the best," Raoul told her as they headed into town. He rolled down the window on his side, filling the car with freezing air, and fished in his coat pocket for a pack of cigarettes. He pushed in the lighter on the dashboard and offered her one, but she shook her head, turning up the heat. She told him that she'd applied to go to London the following year, to do a second master's at the London School of Economics. "You're going to London for a whole year? You can visit me. Why do you need another master's degree?" He sounded distressed and also disapproving. It was the sort of reaction she expected from her parents. Her parents hadn't allowed her to do a junior year abroad at Oxford, telling her then that she was too young to live in a foreign country alone. But now they were excited by the prospect of Sudha going to London, where they'd first lived after getting married and where Sudha had been born, talking about visiting and reconnecting with old friends. She explained that LSE had one of the best programs in developmental economics, that she was thinking of doing NGO work eventually. But Raoul didn't seem to be listening, and she was annoyed with him, with herself really, for agreeing to go out so late at night. "You want a six-pack?" she asked when they got to the liquor store. "I'd prefer a case." In the past, she had paid for things without a second thought, but she was aware now that he did not reach for his wallet. "And a bottle of vodka, too," he added. "Vodka?" He drew another cigarette out of its pack. "It's a long vacation." Their parents were in bed by the time they returned, but Sudha insisted they hide things as they had before. Thinking that their mother might have reason to enter Raoul's room for the weeks that he was home to clean up or put away his laundry, she kept the liquor in her room, a few cans at the back of her closet, some in a gap behind a bookcase, the bottle of Smirnoff wrapped in an old pilly sweater in her chest of drawers. She told Raoul it was safer that way, and he didn't seem to care. He took a couple of cans for the night, pecking her on the cheek before he left her, not insisting when she said she was too tired to join him. He had been born when Sudha was six, and the night her mother went into labor was the first sustained memory of her life. She remembered being at a party in the home of one of her parents' Bengali friends in Peabody, being left there overnight because her father had to take her mother straight to Boston without the suitcase Sudha had helped pack, containing the toothbrush and cold cream and robe her mother would need in the hospital. Though Sudha understood that a baby was about to be born, had felt it with her hand as it sometimes threatened to pound clear through her mother's belly, she was terrified, nevertheless, that her mother, moaning with her forehead pressed against a wall, was dying. "Go away," she said, when Sudha tried to stroke her mother's hand in a tone that had stung. "I don't want you to see me this way." After her parents' departure, the party continued. Sudha was expected to play in the basement with the other children, among the washer and dryer, as dinner was served to adults. The host and hostess did not have children of their own. Sudha had slept on a cot in a spare room containing no permanent furniture, other than an ironing board and a closet devoted to cleaning supplies. In the morning there was no frosted flakes for her to eat, only toast with margarine. And it was then, during that restrained and disappointing adult breakfast, that the phone rang with the news of her brother's arrival. She had been hoping for a sister, but was delighted nevertheless no longer to be an only child, to have someone help fill the emptiness she felt in her parents' home. The few things they owned were always in their places, the two most current issues of Time in the same spot on the coffee table. Sudha preferred the homes of her American friends, crammed and piled with things, toothpaste caking their sinks, their soft beds unmade. Finally, with Raoul's arrival, there was a similar swelling and disorder. His lotions and diapers heaped on top of the dresser, stockpots clattering with boiling bottles on the stove, an infant's strong, milky odor pervading the rooms. She remembered how excited she had been, moving her things to one side to make space in her bedroom for Raoul's bassinet, his changing table, his mobile of stuffed bumblebees. Toys and other gifts accumulated in the crib he would eventually use. Her favorite was a stuffed white rabbit that played a tune if a key at its throat was turned. She had not minded when her mother came in the middle of the night to comfort Raoul, sitting in a rocking chair, singing a song in Bengali, something about a fishbone piercing the foot of a little boy. A song that would lull Sudha back to sleep also. Birth announcements were bought at the drugstore, the card of Sudha's choosing, and she helped to put them in their envelopes, dampening stamps with her father on a wet sponge. Countless photographs were taken, Raoul sleeping in his bassinet, being bathed in a plastic tub, and she took it upon herself to arrange these in a special album with a blue denim cover because he was a boy. There was not the same documentation of Sudha's infancy. In London, after she was born, her parents had rented two rooms in Balham from a Bengali landlord named Mr. Pal, and it was he who had taken the few baby pictures of Sudha that existed, wearing a white lace dress intended for a christening, but that her mother had simply thought pretty. Mr. Pal had opened his doors to her parents when her mother was pregnant with Sudha, providing refuge from their previous landlady, an elderly British woman who did not allow children under her roof. Her parents told her that half the rentals in London in the 60s said, "whites only," and the combination of being Indian and pregnant limited her parents to the point where her father considered sending her mother back to India to give birth, until they met Mr. Pal. To Sudha, this story was like an episode out of a Greek myth or the Bible, rich with blessing and portent, marking her family as survivors in strange, intolerant seas. 4 years later, they moved to Massachusetts, her father transferring from Badger to Raytheon, transporting no evidence of their years in London. No trace apart from her mother's fondness for the McVitie's biscuit she ate every morning with tea, and her lifelong belief in the quality of British brassieres, which she asked friends in the UK to mail her every so often. None of Sudha's toys had made it on the journey across the Atlantic. No baby clothing or bedding or keepsake of any kind. In grade school, when Sudha had been required to present her autobiography to the class, a project for which the other students brought in blankets and scuffed shoes and blackened spoons, she came only with an envelope containing pictures Mr. Pal had taken, boring her classmates as she stood at the front of the room. None of this mattered after Raoul arrived. Sudha had slipped through the cracks, but she was determined that her little brother should leave his mark as a child in America. She sought out all the right toys for him, scavenging from yard sales to Fisher-Price Barn, Tonka trucks, the speak and say that made animal sounds, and other things that she had discovered in the playrooms of her friends. She asked her parents to buy him the books she'd read by her first teachers, Peter Rabbit and Frog and Toad. "What's the point of buying books for someone who can't read?" her parents asked, legitimately enough, and so she checked them out of her school library and read them to Raoul herself. She told her parents to set up sprinklers on the lawn for him to run through in the summer, and she convinced her father to put a swing set in the yard. She thought up elaborate Halloween costumes, turning him into an elephant or a refrigerator, while hers had come from boxes, a flimsy apron, and a weightless mask. At times she engaged with Raoul's upbringing more than he did. It was she, too heavy by then for the seats, who would swing in the yard after school, she who spent hours building towns out of Lincoln logs that he would destroy with a gleeful swipe of the hand. Though she doted on him and adored him, she began to envy him in small ways. She envied him for his lean limbs, while she grew slightly pudgy once her period came, and she envied him because people could call him Raoul, that he could introduce himself in crowds without questions. She envied him for his beauty. Even when he was a child, there was a clear sense of the handsome man he would become. His face defied the family mold. Sudha, with her father's rounded chin and her mother's low hairline, was transparently their offspring. But Raoul looked little like either of them. His genes pulled not from the surface, but from some deeper, forgotten source. His complexion was darker, his skin an unmistakable brown, his pronounced features lacking the indeterminate quality she and her parents shared. He was allowed to wear shorts in the summer, to play sports in school, things her mother considered inappropriate for a girl. Suda supposed it was a combination of his being a boy and being younger, and her parents being more at ease with the way things worked in America by then. Suda had no fondness for her younger self, no sentimental affection for the way she had looked or the things she had done. What she felt was an overwhelming sense of regret for what exactly she did not know. She had looked, of course, perfectly ordinary, her black hair worn in pigtails or braids, grown to her waist 1 year, and cut like Dorothy Hamill's the next. And she had done ordinary things, attended slumber parties, and played clarinet in the school band, and sold chocolate bars from door to door. And yet she could not forgive herself. Even as an adult, she wished only that she could go back and change things. The ungainly things she had worn, the insecurity she had felt, all the innocent mistakes she had made. Thanks to Raoul, there was also someone else to witness the perplexing fact of her parents' marriage. It was neither happy nor unhappy, and the lack of emotion in either extreme was what upset Suda most. She would have understood quarrels. She believed she would have even understood divorce. She always hoped some sign of love would manifest itself. The only things that consoled her were a few pictures taken during their London years. Her mother looked unrecognizably slim, hair styled at a salon, a woven purse shaped like a cornucopia dangling from the crook of her elbow. Even her saris were glamorous back then, tightly wrapped to show off her figure, patterned with a spidery brown batik. Her father seemed vaguely mod, wearing suits with narrow dark ties and sunglasses. Those were the days, Suda supposed, when immigration was still an adventure, living with paraffin heaters, seeing snow for the first time. Wayland was the shock. Suddenly they were stuck, her parents aware that they faced a life sentence of being foreign. In London, her mother had been working towards a certificate in Montessori education, but in America she did not work, did not drive. She put on 20 pounds after Raoul was born, and her father put away his mod suits and shopped at Sears. In Wayland they became passive, wary, the rituals of small-town New England more confounding than negotiating two of the world's largest cities. They relied on their children, on Suda especially. It was she who had to explain to her father that he had to gather up the leaves in bags, not just drag them with his rake to the woods opposite the house. She, with her perfect English, who called the repair department at Leechmere to have their appliances serviced. Raoul never considered it his duty to help his parents in this way. While Suda regarded her parents' separation from India as an ailment that ebbed and flowed like a cancer, Raoul was impermeable to that aspect of their life as well. "No one dragged them here," he would say. "Baba left India to get rich, and Ma married him because she had nothing else to do." That was Raoul, always aware of the family's weaknesses, never sparing Suda from the thing she least wanted to face. Another semester passed before she saw him again. She was accepted at LSE, and in June she came home to Wayland for a week. During her visit, Suda gave herself fully to her parents, watching Wimbledon with her father on television, helping her mother cook and order new blinds for the bedrooms. She was always in the house, while Raoul drifted in and out without explanation. He was waiting tables part-time at a seafood restaurant out in Scituate, 35 miles away, sleeping most days, working dinner shifts, out with friends after that. These were no longer friends from high school, boys Suda had known since Raoul started kindergarten. Instead, they were people he met working at the restaurant, people he never bothered to invite home. His aloofness troubled Suda, but her parents said nothing. He seemed always to be in a slightly bad mood and in urgent need to get somewhere, to his job, to a gym where he went to lift weights, to the video store to return one of the foreign films he would watch when everyone else was asleep. She and Raoul never argued, but there were moments when she crossed paths with him in the hallway, or asked him to pass her the remote control, when she was briefly convinced he despised her. It was nothing he said or did. Even in his avoidance, he was always coolly polite. But she sensed that he had revised his opinion of her, that the Raoul who once looked up to her and confided in her was replaced by a person she could only offend. She wondered when he would approach her for another run to the liquor store, but he never mentioned it. She gathered he had his own supply, stashed away somewhere. One night when she was up late reading a magazine, She heard the sound of the ice machine grinding in the refrigerator, cubes dropping into a glass. She learned from her mother that his second semester grades had been bad. The first semester, the lowest was a B, but now he'd gotten mostly C's. He had dropped biology and organic chemistry and taken up film and English literature instead. "Can you talk to him?" her mother asked Sudha. "Find out what went wrong?" Sudha came to Raoul's defense, saying that it was an enormous adjustment going from high school to college, that a lot of students had a hard time. Her father did not hide his disapproval, and while he did not confront Raoul, one day he said to Sudha, "He is floundering." He did not approve of paying an astronomical tuition just so Raoul could watch French movies in a classroom. Her father had no patience for failure, for indulgences. He never let his children forget that there had been no one to help him as he helped them, so that no matter how well Sudha did, she felt that her good fortune had been handed to her, not earned. Both her parents came from humble backgrounds. Both their grandmothers had given up the gold on their arms to put roofs over their families' heads and food on their plates. This mentality, as tiresome as it sometimes felt, also reassured Sudha, for it was something her parents understood and respected about each other, and she suspected it was the glue that held them together. Late one night, she knocked on Raoul's door. He was lying in bed listening to music on his headphones, leafing through a tattered copy of Beckett's plays. He put the book on his chest when he saw her, but didn't remove the headphones. She saw a mug on the floor by the bed, filled with ice cubes and a clear liquid. He didn't offer any, was playing their old game without her. "So what's going on at school?" she asked. He looked up at her. His eyes were reddish. "I'm on vacation." "Your grades weren't good, Raoul. You need to work a little harder." "I did work hard," he said. "I know the first year can be tough." "I did work hard," he repeated. "My professors hate me. Is that my fault?" "I'm sure they don't hate you," she said. She considered crossing the room and sitting on the edge of the bed, but she remained where she was. "What the fuck do you know?" he said, giving her a start. "Look, I'm just trying to help." "I'm not asking you to help. You don't need to fix anything. Has it ever occurred to you that my life might be fine the way it is?" His words silenced her, cut to the bone. She'd always had a heavy hand in his life, it was true, striving not to control it but to improve it somehow. She'd always considered this her responsibility to him. She had not known how to be a sister any other way. "You don't even live here," he continued. "You think you can stroll in and make everything perfect before you disappear to London? Is that what you want to do?" She looked at him, and then at the mug at the side of his bed, wondering how much he had consumed in the course of the evening, where the bottle was hidden. She thought of her parents sleeping down the hall, unaware of what he was doing, and she felt indignant on their behalf. "You're smart, Raoul. You're a lot smarter than me. I don't get it." He leaned over and picked up the cup from the floor. He took a sip and swallowed, then slid the cup under the bed out of sight. "You don't have to get it, Didi. You don't have to get everything all the time." On Sudha's last night before heading back to Philadelphia, he surprised them, agreeing to go out to a restaurant to celebrate her impending departure for England. Their parents were in good moods, reminiscing about London, trying to remember the order of stops on the Piccadilly line. Raoul was jovial too, telling Sudha about all the writers' homes and graves she should visit while she was there. He spoke with an aggressive authority, as if he'd been to Marx's tomb himself, and for the first time it occurred to Sudha that perhaps Raoul was jealous of those years she and her parents had lived in England. Those years when Raoul did not exist. He ordered a Singapore sling and nursed it slowly through the meal. He mentioned nothing about having plans later on, but before the check came, he looked at his watch and leapt up from the table, saying he was late for something, and left in his own car. Sudha went home with her parents, was up watching Spellbound on the VCR when the phone rang. It was Raoul calling from the local police station. He'd been pulled over on a quiet road near Mill Pond for wavering in his lane. His blood alcohol content was not extreme, but because he was under 21, it was enough to get him arrested. He asked Sudha to come to the station alone to bring $300 in cash. But it was past midnight, and besides, the keys to her parents' car were in the pocket of her father's pants in their bedroom. She woke up her father, told him to get dressed. Together they went to post bail and release Raoul from the cell. Her father drove, his face creased with sleep, seeming disoriented in the town he'd lived in for years. They stopped at an ATM and withdrew money. You go, her father said when they reached the station. I prefer to wait in the car. His voice faltered as he spoke, as it had the day he had called Suda in college to tell her his father died. And so she spared her father that humiliation, that pain, entering a place where handcuffed criminals were brought. When she saw Raoul, he was sober, the pads of his fingers blackened from ink. It was a Sunday night, the arraignment scheduled for the following day. Will you go with me? He asked as they walked back to the car, and he was shaken enough for her to reassure him that she would. It's ridiculous, her mother said the next morning as Raoul slept. She blamed the police for overreacting. It's not like he had an accident. He was only going 40 miles an hour. They probably stopped him just for being Indian. Her father said nothing. He sat sipping his tea and reading the Sunday Globe. He'd said nothing on the way home. That wasn't the problem, Suda said slowly, forcing cold butter across the surface of her toast. What are you saying, Suda? Her mother asked, sounding bothered. Her father did not put down his paper, but she sensed that he had stopped reading. Suda knew what she was about to say was something they expected and also viscerally feared, like disobedient children who are about to be slapped, that it was up to her to deliver the blow. I think Raoul might have a drinking problem. Suda, please, her mother said. After a pause, she added, I gather everyone at American colleges drinks. She spoke as if drinking were an undergraduate hobby, a phase one outgrew. Not like that. Didn't you drink in college? Not like that, Suda repeated. Not enough to get arrested, she was tempted to say. That's the problem with this country, her mother said. Too many freedoms, too much having fun. When we were young, life wasn't always about fun. Suda pitied her mother, pitied her refusal to accommodate such an unpleasant and alien fact, her need to blame America and its laws instead of her son. She sensed that her father understood, but he refused to engage in the conversation, refused to confront Raoul when he eventually came downstairs, showered and penitent, promising never to do such a thing again. Her parents had always been blind to the things that plagued their children, being teased at school for the color of their skin, or for the funny things their mother occasionally put into their lunchboxes, potato curry sandwiches that tinted Wonder Bread green. What could there possibly be to be unhappy about, her parents would have thought. Depression was a foreign word to them, an American thing. In their opinion, their children were immune from the hardships and injustices they left behind in India, as if the inoculations the pediatrician had given Suda and Raoul when they were babies guaranteed them an existence free of suffering. She was excited to be in London, curious to know the land of her birth. Before leaving, she had applied for her British passport, a document her parents had not obtained for her when she was born, and when she presented it at Heathrow, the immigration officer welcomed her home. Her parents went with her and stayed 10 days, settling her into the hall of residence off Tottenham Court Road. They reminded her to look right before crossing the street, bought her cardigans from Marks and Spencer's to see her through the winter. They took her to Balham on the tube to show her the house where she'd been an infant. Together they made a trip to Sheffield, 3 hours away through the countryside, where their old landlord, Mr. Pal, now lived with his family. They did not speak of Raoul unless forced to by friends, and when they did, it was always the same, unobjectionably impressive facts about him, that he was at Cornell, a sophomore now. These facts gave her parents a feeble hope, as if college, where he'd begun to fall apart, would magically put him together again. After her parents left, she grew busy with her classes, and with a new friend she made, who came from all over the world, joining them to study and sightsee and visit pubs. Perhaps because it was her birthplace, she felt an instinctive connection to London, a sense of belonging, though she barely knew her way around. In spite of the ocean that now separated her from her parents, she felt closer to them, but she also felt free, for the first time in her life, of her family's weight. Still, she could not drink anymore without thinking of Raoul, always conscious that the second pint she drained, satisfied at the end of a night out, would not have been enough for him. At the arraignment, she had sat next to him in the crowded courtroom, waiting for his name to be called, listening as the charges were read. She was there to stand by him, to support him, but in that place of judgment, she was not on his side. His license was suspended for 6 months, and he was ordered to attend some alcohol education classes in Ithaca. In the end, her father had had to pay nearly $2,000 in fines and fees. The arrest was mentioned in the Wayland Town Crier, a paper her parents received. In November, wandering through the National Gallery, she met a man. She had been admiring the Arnold Fini Marriage by Van Eyck, lingering in front of it after a cluster of people had passed. It was an oil painting of a couple in a bedroom, holding hands, with a small dog standing at their feet. The man wore a fur-trimmed purple cape and an overly large black straw hat. The woman wore an emerald green gown that trailed like a heavy curtain onto the floor, some of the material gathered up in her left hand. She had a white veil on her head and looked possibly pregnant. Suda wasn't sure. There was a window behind the man, with a piece of fruit, an apricot or a tangerine, on the sill. On the wall hung a convex mirror that reflected everything in the painting. "Come closer," the man next to Suda said, ushering her a few steps forward so that no one could cross their line of vision. "Otherwise you can't really see." He started talking about the mirror, how it was the focal point of the painting, capturing the floor and the ceiling, the room, and the world outside. And then she saw that it reflected not only the couple, but also a pair of men standing in the doorway, peering into the room just as she was. "One of them is Van Eyck," the man said. "That's what the inscription above the mirror says. It's Latin for, Van Eyck was here." He spoke softly, as if for Suda alone, with the sing-song British cadence that was already influencing Suda's speech. His dark hair was slightly long, and he kept raking it with his fingers away from his face. She could smell the slightly spiced soap on his skin. He wore a tweed blazer and corduroy pants and carried a raincoat draped over one arm. He told her that the two men in the doorway of the painting were witnessing the couple's union, adding that the painting was intended to serve as a marriage certificate. "Of course, that's just one interpretation," the man said. "Some argue that it's a betrothal scene." She studied the details he spoke of, the glow of the paint, conscious of their shared gaze. "What about the shoes? Do they mean something?" Suda heard herself asking, pointing to a pair of abandoned wooden clogs in the foreground, and then to some red slippers by the carpet. The man turned to Suda then. He was older than she expected, closer to 40 judging from the eyes, clear blue eyes that settled calmly upon different points of her face. His expression was serious, placidly cast, but the sides of his mouth now rose up in a smile. "I suspect it means they're standing on holy ground. Either that or she just went shopping." She had not known that day what a famous painting it was, but the man never made her feel ignorant. They walked to other paintings, the man bending his head down towards Suda's and talking about them, and eventually he asked if she would like to join him for tea. His name was Roger Featherstone. He had a PhD in art history, was an editor at an art magazine, and had also written a book about Renaissance portraiture. He wooed Suda consistently, romantically. Flowers every time he knocked on the door, gifts of gloves and earrings and perfume. He was an only child who had grown up in English boarding schools. His father had worked overseas for Singer sewing machines, and now both his parents were dead. Roger was born in India, spent the first 3 years of his life in Bombay, but remembered nothing. He had been married in his 20s to a girl he'd known at Cambridge. After 2 years, she left him, renounced her possessions, and joined a Buddhist monastery in Tibet. He took responsibility for things, booking theater tickets, making reservations at restaurants, packing picnics, and dragging Suda off to Hampstead Heath. He was the first man she'd dated who was never late, never forgot to call when he said he would, and Suda quickly recognized in him the same strain of competence she possessed. He enjoyed food and cooking, inspired to get up early and walk to a favorite bakery for pastries, surprising Suda the first morning she woke up in his flat in Shepherd's Bush, with breakfast on a tray. He had lived alone for many years but quickly opened his life to her, giving her a key, lined drawers in his bureau, a glass shelf in his medicine cabinet. In his youth, he had dreamed of being a painter, had enrolled at Chelsea Art School, but after a teacher told him he would not go far, he never touched a canvas again. He was not bitter about this turn of events. Like Suda, he was a person who understood what his limits were. At the same time, he could be exacting, writing withering reviews for his magazine, insisting on the best table at restaurants, sending back wine. Like Suda, he was moderate with alcohol, always ordering a bottle for the table, but seldom consuming more than a glass or two. As Christmas approached, she told her parents that she had too much work and did not come home, when in fact she and Roger went away together, to Seville, and then to Costa del Sol. When she returned from Spain, there was a message at the switchboard of her dormitory from her parents, asking her to call. When she did, from one of the payphones in the lobby of the dorm, they told her that Raúl's grades had not improved, that a letter had come from an advisor, expressing concern. He was in Weyland now for Christmas break. After one explosive fight, he'd stopped speaking to them. She was glad that Roger wasn't there to overhear the call, that he'd kissed her goodbye in the taxi and gone back to his flat. She'd painted a hazy image of her family that he absorbed as if it were an endnote in a book, something stemming from her but safely tucked out of sight. "I can't wait to meet them," he told her, words that Suda hoped made his intentions clear. Beyond the basic details, he did not probe, and so she did not tell Roger about Raúl's drinking, about his arrest, about the fact she had not talked to her brother in months. Her parents asked her to speak to Raúl, saying he had gone out for a walk to try in a little while. She waited a few days. She was surprised after all these months by how upset she felt. And she was upset at her parents, too, for still depending on her to help. She called from Roger's flat, putting the charges on a card while Roger was at work. Raúl had turned 20 in the first week of January, a thing she'd let pass without acknowledgement. He picked up the phone and she wished him happy birthday now. It was noon in Massachusetts, early evening in London. The sky was dark through Roger's kitchen window. At the counter, Suda was setting out cheese and crackers and olives for her and Roger to eat together when he got home. "Things okay?" she asked. "Everything's fine. Ma and Baba are getting totally hysterical over nothing." Raúl spoke as if no strain existed between them, asking her how London was.
"They said you failed two classes."
"They were lousy classes."
"Are you even going to your classes?"
"Lay off, Dee Dee," he said, his mood turning.
"Are you?"
she persisted. There was a pause. She heard the flicking of a lighter, the first pent-up exhale of a cigarette. "I don't want to be doing this."
"What do you want to do?"
she asked, not bothering to conceal her exasperation. "I'm writing a play." She was surprised by this information and found it promising that he was actually doing something. He had always been a good writer. Once when he was in high school, he'd written a response to one of the take-home essay questions she had had on a philosophy exam at Penn, a question about Plato's Euthyphro that her professor had approved of with a lengthy comment. She put an olive in her mouth, extracted the thin purple pit, and placed it on a painted dish she and Roger had bought together in Seville. "That's great, Raúl, but you have to study, too."
"I want to drop out."
"Ma and Baba aren't going to go for that. Finish